Greetings and welcome to Bee's Table Talk, the podcast in which we have great conversations about business and our economy. My name is Bee Kyle, President and CEO of the St. Paul Area Chamber, and I'm glad you joined us. I always enjoy these, my chance to have conversations with leaders among us doing great things within the community and within their organizations. My guest today is a chamber member and leader within the state and the national health landscape. As of 2021, Dr. Joe Lee is the president and CEO of the Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation. He's been with Hazelden organization for about 14 years. Dr. Lee was the medical director for Hazelden Betty Ford's youth services for 11 years. He is known as a thought leader on matters related to addiction, mental health, and recovery. A triple boarded physician, he completed his adult psychiatry residency at Duke University Hospital and his fellowship in child and adolescent psychiatry from Johns Hopkins Hospital. He is a diplomat of the American Board of Addiction Medicine and is a member of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Substance Abuse Disorder Committee. That's a mouthful. But Dr. Lee, welcome to the program and thank you for sitting down with me.
Thanks for having us on. It's a real pleasure.
Well, I have to tell you, I read Duke University and I'm a Chapel Hill girl. You know, we're a Chapel Hill family. So, you know, I'm going to have to grant you some grace in spite of that.
Appreciate it. You know, my wife is a part. My wife is a Tar Heel. My wife.
Oh, nice.
She actually got her master's degree at Duke. She's a nurse practitioner. She does pediatric oncology, but she will disavow the Duke part. So she's a Tar Heel, and we had a very painful family experience watching Coach K's last game.
Lost
at the hand of the Tar Heels, and so yeah, it's a sore subject right now. But we can still be friends.
That's good to know. Well, I appreciate you being gracious with me, and I'll do the same. Well, and so because I believe North Carolina is paradise, why in the world and how did you come to Minnesota? We'd love to know more about that.
Yeah, the joke I tell is that I was at Johns Hopkins finishing my child and adolescent psychiatry fellowship, and one day I got lost in the snow, and I just filled up gas and kept driving and then got stuck somewhere. And I don't know how much time passed and these people like rescued me. And either built me an ice hut or something. And when the snow thawed, I was in Minnesota and I've been here ever since. That's the story I tell. But
you get here, you can't leave us because this is really a fabulous place to be. You have to admit, right?
It is actually a fabulous place. And, yeah. And so it's the first reaction of people that don't live here are like, why Minnesota? But it's an incredible place. You know, the civic engagement here in the state and how people really move together. And certainly there's problems like every other state, but there's great culture, great commerce, and a lot of good partners that are invested in giving back to the community. And I think it's a special state. I think it's a real gem. So maybe the weather is a good thing because then people don't know what a good deal we have here. But I grew up in Oklahoma. I'm an immigrant. I'm a naturalized citizen. I came from Seoul, South Korea to Norman, Oklahoma when I was 7. And that was a big culture shock. My dad was a chemical engineer and then kind of gave up his career to get a PhD. And so my mom worked as a housekeeper and kind of sacrificed her art career as an art teacher. And we kind of started over here in the States. And so a lot of people on my immigrant journey that I'm grateful for. And so sometimes it almost feels like a different life now that I have this real privilege of leading such a fabulous organization. But I mentioned that immigrant story. I didn't get naturalized until I was an intern at Duke, actually. I drove to Greensboro, North Carolina, one of the best days of my life. But the reason I tell that story is that it's a time of change and good change for our organization and for addiction and recovery. That story is important because I have employees and other stakeholders who come to me and they tell me that, my experience symbolizes hope for them. And that's incredibly humbling to hear. I was just in Naples, Florida, actually. And an employee came up to me and paraphrasing, she said something to the effect of me being CEO helped her realize that as an immigrant herself, She had told herself a lot of stories about what wasn't possible in her life. And then now that she saw things differently. So that was really kind of overwhelming in a good way to hear. But I share that story just to say that there are lots of paths to help people and be part of a fabulous community.
Well, I appreciate that. And if you'll allow me to tell a story in return, you'll appreciate this.
Yes.
Talk about hope, which made me think of this. So in my career, I spent a lot of years in capital in manufacturing, capital equipment, and I'd have a territory that was the southern half of Minnesota all the way to Rapid City, South Dakota, the whole state and a half. And so I'd be on the road a lot, driving to manufacturing shops, tour their shops, talking about big equipment. And when I get on the road, I just say a prayer, Lord, let me be an angel to somebody on this journey. I don't know what that looks like, but let me be that. So, you know, one trip, I was driving back from Sioux Falls. This was pre-cell phones, and I was in the process of getting a new job. So I had to stop at public places to use the phone to check in, see if they called me with a good news. So I stopped at one place, and I'd hit 35, and as I was heading north, stopped at a big truck stop, walk over to this bank of phones, and there was a grandma and a grandpa and a granddaughter, 9, in front of the bank of phones. And he's clearly deaf, yelling at the phone because he can't hear these people. So he didn't even yell, so they'll hear him better. So he's yelling at the phone, and grandma's looking nervous, and the child, whatever. But the grandma looks at me and grabs me because I just said, you know, can I help? He's trying to get directions. And she grabs the phone from her husband, throws the phone in my hands, and I'm like, hello. And it was Hazelden. And grandma and grandpa had flew in from Texas to the airport. And we're now an hour and a half south of the cities because they couldn't figure out the directions, which Hazelden, we all know, is on the, well, your main facility is on the north end of the city. Now, the angel part of it was, I used to live in Shoreview, right near the facility. I had families who've been there, God bless you for the work you do. So I knew where you were and I knew what you did. And therefore I'm looking at this family and they tell me, they're going to visit their daughter and bring their granddaughter to see mom at Hazelden, and they'd gotten lost. I told them, follow me, because trying to give them directions between the splits and 35 was going to be challenging. So they followed me from Owatonna all the way up to the Lionel Lakes area. And I just drove them to the main gate and I waved goodbye and I drove off. And that's been 20 years since I had that opportunity to serve that family. It was so special. So when you talk about hope, that's what you do for people. And it was really my opportunity to get to do that.
Well, thank you for sharing that. That's incredibly inspirational. And I know it was great for you too, to be a piece of the journey. And, you know, that's also what makes Hazelden Betty Ford special, but it also makes the people of the state of Minnesota special, because those are stories that we hear a lot, and they're great to hear.
Well, tell us a little bit about Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation. Big title, important work. Introduce us to the history and mission.
Well, gosh, you know, in a couple of years, we're going to be celebrating our 75th anniversary.
Wow.
And I think the important part about the organization, when I look at it through a fresh lens, that younger people might, because, you know, I spent my career as a child psychiatrist with young people and families. And I think what's special about the organization and then the Betty Ford legacy when we did the merger with the Betty Ford Center is that our organization stood up against stigma before it was kind of the cool thing to do, before people recognized it was a medical illness. People were shunned in many parts of society and they needed a haven. And that was the spirit of Hazelden Betty Ford and why it was born. First Lady Ford was a champion for stigma, also a champion for women talking about addiction. And she also talks about, you know, breast cancer and other things that she was a champion for. So there was this kind of historic significance in what it symbolized and the spirit of its birth. And then it really, how it helped people, inspired a lot of people, changed cultures, grew self-help groups with AA and other treatment communities across the country and across the world. And I think that's really the legacy of Hazelden Betty Ford. This is a grassroots effort that decades before addiction talk became something in mainstream news, took a stand and supported people. And now we're now sitting on this incredible legacy, and I have this awesome privilege of continuing the legacy of a lot of people, so many thousands of lives, people who've sacrificed and represented people with addiction in their families who didn't have a voice before. So that's something that's probably what I'm most proud of our legacy.
Well, and I appreciate that. And you bring with you an incredible legacy. In researching you, because I didn't know you before I got a chance to interview with you, discovered that you're the author of Recovering My Kid, Parenting Young Adults in Treatment and Beyond, which is a guide for parents in time of crisis. Tell us about the book and why did you feel compelled to write it?
I'm actually, I'm not super interested in writing all the time. I'm actually, I love people. I love people. I'm not a person who's eager for everybody to hear my ideas on some social media platform. I'm actually quite the opposite. But I was seeing these families from across the country, and I had been influenced by at Duke University and at Johns Hopkins, great physicians, psychiatrists, clinicians. And I worked with families. When you work with families in inner city Baltimore at these schools, you learn something about some fundamentals of parenting in crisis. And so I came to Hazelden. It was just Hazelden at the time, because we hadn't merged yet with Betty Ford. And I found that a lot of these families needed help. I came to recognize that addiction was a family disease and that people needed help, and parents, caregivers, they needed support. And so I took a lot of the wisdom that I learned through my residency training and my clinical experience, and I just wanted to write it down. It was a very simple book. It was done with very humble intent, and it was really just meant for the people who were in a tough spot. And so it wasn't designed to send some novel TED Talk idea. It was really just, hey, here's my experience working with thousands of families, and here's how you can navigate some things with perspective. So it was a real simple book. I'm honored you mentioned it, because it's just to me, it was just like an easy thing to do for the families that we served. And that's who it was designed for.
Well, you speak to easy to write down because of the breadth of your experience. And yet for the individual family in crisis, this is a once in a lifetime moment. And so they have no context or reference. So simple maybe, but crucial, critical for the families who need it. I'd like to talk a little bit about families in crisis and working with, particularly within the context of the pandemic. I've done a lot of reading over the last couple of years, as I'm sure you have, about increased isolation, increased use of substance abuse during these last 2 years, and even beyond that with opioid addiction and whatnot that we've been seeing and hearing about for years now. But tell us a little bit, what are your observations, your experience, and the trend you're seeing? How did the pandemic impact it, and what are some changes ahead, do you think?
Yeah, difficult times in society, whether it's a recession or a pandemic, tend to affect those at risk disproportionately. Mm-hmm. And it's not just people prone to addiction, it's minority populations and other, disenfranchised individuals. And so you do see rates of substance use go up historically in these moments. You see depression, suicidality, all these markers go up. And that's what happened in the pandemic. We predicted that this would be the case. And so it was a really interesting convergence, especially here in the Twin Cities. There was a lot of societal change and turmoil with the murder of George Floyd, as you know. And when the pandemic hit, kind of around that time, it highlighted to me that one, we were a really stigmatized industry still. And the reason I knew that is because we were at the very back of the line in the healthcare profession for getting masks and testing. And I was a frontline kind of medical director at the time, side by side with our nurses, our counselors, our housekeeping. And it was a very scary time. We didn't know what it was. We knew that was potentially deadly. We were making like cloth masks and doing whatever we could. And so that part was difficult, and it highlighted how addiction was still stigmatized, and the resourcing, of it, or the lack thereof, kind of clearly displayed that. But I also saw the people in our organization be incredibly inspired. They rose up to the challenge. They decided to come to work anyway because we were seeing higher and higher rates of substance use, and people were delaying care, and people were sicker than ever before, and they were scared. And so we were a haven to them. So it was a real inspirational character test for our organization, actually. And what we continue to see out there is we have record number of overdose deaths in the country now. And a lot of it is due to fentanyl.
Okay, say a little bit about fentanyl. So yeah. What is there a street word for fentanyl? Is there a way you use it? You know, I've heard this recently and I really don't have a lot of context for it.
Well, the
thing is, give me that face. He's giving me, listeners, he's giving me that face like, really?
No. Okay, I'm trying to think, like, how do I not go into nerd mode and just kind of make it so that it's a conversation? Well, actually, you know, I see a lot of, let's say, entrepreneurial young people.
Entrepreneurial young people. Yes. Nice. Okay. Yeah,
they're good at drug dealing and they understand the black market. And so I just came to accidentally understand the black market better than just about anybody else. How much drugs sold for, at what price, where you go to get it, how the market works. And so I saw fentanyl coming down the pike years ago, actually. And fentanyl is a synthetic opioid, meaning it's not a naturally occurring chemical for pain, and but it's man-made and it's very potent. And what that means is just a little bit goes a very long way. So, you know, some medications are dosed 1,000 milligrams a pill. Others are dosed like 5 milligrams a pill. The 5 milligram one is more potent. So fentanyl is very potent compared to other opioids. And I saw years ago, kids were buying it on the dark web using Bitcoin, actually. And so Bitcoin actually is kind of this hidden catalyst in the opioid epidemic because it made it easy for young people to buy from these labs. And they would get the powder bags of fentanyl and they would mix it into water bottles or cut it into pills. Well, soon enough, the rest of the black market caught on to this. And so they started making connections with these labs. And you, there were three stages of the opioid epidemic people need to know about. The first is with oxycodone and prescription pills, doctor's office, pain's a fifth vital sign, that kind of nonsense. And that caused a lot of harm and destruction. And we lost a lot of lives. But when we started to clamp down on the pills, we moved into the second stage of the opioid epidemic, which was heroin, because now people were hooked. They wanted to use pain medications and they couldn't get the pain medications. They went to heroin. The third stage happened was while seeing these kids, because, you know, once the heroin market becomes competitive, you want to make more profit. And so you start to cut things into the heroin to make more margin. Mm-hmm. And fentanyl became a popular drug to cut into other drugs because it packed a pop and it was cheap. And so you could cut it into what was supposed to be heroin or Xanax or other drugs. And the results have been catastrophic. So we're now in this third phase of the opioid epidemic. Fentanyl has been brewing for a long time. And now it's really taken a toll where we had over 100,000 overdoses in the country last year.
So how has this been specifically impacting you? That's your area of specialty. Is that you have any particular observations about youth and the direction? And is there something we can do to be a part of, at least knowing more, helps us to be more informed when these conversations come up?
Yes.
It's especially impactful for the youth because they're struggling with isolation and such?
Yes. I think young people and families in particular struggling with isolation in the pandemic made the crisis of addiction worse. You know, let me just give you one example. I think all of us have our two cents about how schools could be better. But if you flip it on the other side, the work that teachers and other school administrators do and what a linchpin is in our society, because when we removed schools, you know, from the equation and they went virtual, that caused a lot of harm to kids. Mm. So you had kids who were maybe bullied or didn't have many friends or they were depressed. And what do young people do? When I was growing up, if I had a bad year, I just look forward to the next year because you'd make new friends and you get a fresh start. Well, imagine if you eliminate that for a lot of kids who are already falling through the cracks. And that's what you started to see. So you started to see kids who were already at risk for addiction or other mental health issues, and they had no save socially. They kind of ran out of resources. And the school, which was oftentimes the sentinel for detecting mental health and other problems, was not present in their lives. And so it took a really catastrophic toll. So that was really painful for me to watch. Mm-hmm. As a clinician, and it kind of, you know, if you look at some Western countries, actually, initially in the pandemic, rates of child abuse went down, But that's actually not true. What actually happened was because schools were closed, people weren't detecting child abuse. That's right. So it just shows you the importance of schools. So that's just one example of where the pandemic and the fentanyl crisis and everything kind of converged. And I made a decision sometime in the pandemic when I threw my head in the ring for the CEO position, is it was a time of change and I felt it. And I was perfectly happy working with families. I love working with families. I love the people that we work with. Absolutely. But I came to this fork in the road where, gosh, all these things are happening and we're going to either help one family at a time, or now's my chance to help groups of families at a time. And so I kind of took a right turn, you know, at that juncture, because the fentanyl crisis, the pandemic and the epidemic really just took a big toll on me and sent me a clear message.
Well, gosh, you know, so many of us in our families, in our communities are observing, or for that matter, experiencing substance abuse. And as we're coming out of the pandemic, you know, there's this next normal, which is different than it was two plus years ago. What advice do you have for folks as we're reconnecting, plugging back in again, seeing folks again, and, you know, substance abuse is there? Do you have any advice for us as we're making that transition?
Yes. Lots of advice, but also a lot of kind of wanting to listen to their perspectives. And I'd say first is, you know, the number one protective factor against substance use disorders in families is that family relationship. And I think for families, even if they don't have addiction, investing in that relationship and the strength of that relationship is the best thing that you can do. And for families who are already in crisis and struggling with it, don't give up hope. You know, there's value. Even if initially your person, loved one's recovery isn't going gangbusters like you want, there's hope in keeping them alive and keeping them engaged. And so people have this short-sighted view due to stigma. Okay, it's due to stigma where they don't want to understand the nuance. And so they think of addiction as like celebrity rehab or something like that, even though our treatment is very innovative and sophisticated now. And they think about going to treatment, and if some episode doesn't work, they'll use the word like failure. But that's actually not true. When you track these people in research, and this is John Kelly's research from Mass General, once people get to about a year of sobriety, their prognosis goes up. It skyrockets, and they do very, very well. In fact, a lot of people do well. What people get caught up in is kind of that initial stage, because they might have to go to outpatient treatment 3-4 times, and that's not a failure. It's as long as people are engaging and they're staying alive and they're staying in a positive direction, the data is in their favor. So my advice to families is, you might be in the thick of the tornado right now, but do the things to keep your person engaged and supported, and just keep going, because there's hope. The data and the science say that the longer they stay engaged in any kind of treatment, the better and better they're going to do as the years progress. And so it's very hard, easy when you're in the fog of addiction and things are happening and there's lots of stuff and legal issues and everything else to lose hope. And so my message would be, don't lose that hope. You know, you're just kind of in the eye of it. But I've seen so many, I've been blessed to be just a small part of so many long-lasting recovery stories on the other end. You know, I get so many postcards and letters and pictures, and there's tragic stories too along the way, but by and large, I know that there's a lot of hope for people. So there's people suffering right now, and they should just get engaged. Don't worry about, you know, what level of success initially, to just keep trying and you're going to make it.
How many folks do you serve a year right now in Hazelden?
We serve about 25,000 people a year, but we want to serve millions. You know, we're not happy with 25,000. We're very happy with 25,000, but we're not satisfied with 25,000. We want to serve and impact millions of lives. And we have a unique opportunity to do that because we have a prevention arm, actually, where we go into schools and we teach prevention programs that are evidence-based. And we have a consulting arm, so we can train people at hospitals and we can train doctors, and we work with over 60 different American Indian tribes. So we have a way to kind of spread our message and impact in different ways. We have a children's program, a research center, a graduate school to crank out counselors. And so we're all in helping the community out in whichever way. It's not just traditional treatment. And by multiplying all those things, we want to impact millions. That's what we want to do.
So how do people find you? I live in Invergrove Heights. My office is in downtown St. Paul. Businesses are from all over the metro and indeed the country. How does someone who really needs a place to start, how do they find you?
You know, just give us a call or go online and check us out. We're really easy to access. Our call lines are open 24/7 and they'll match you to the kind of treatment you need. It might be some prevention work. It might be family services. It might be mental health care related to addiction. I think people have to see that treatment now is very sophisticated and tailored to meet where you're at. It could be telehealth services, but it just starts with going on our website, making a couple of clicks, signing a call if you want. It's okay if you're ambivalent or unsure about it. I think it's just great to make that personal connection initially. And that's where we're about. We have a lot of brick and mortar sites in Minnesota as well, because that is where our flagships are. And so there's lots of ways for people to get in touch and lots of ways that people connect.
And you have facilities in St. Paul, if I'm not mistaken. Yep. Your St. Paul location over on the west side?
That's right. That's right. I'm at the St. Paul location right now. Speaking to you. And so it's a great sober living residence and a great hub for the community. They have meetings and it's a really vibrant recovery community that we're part of. And we had a hand in really fueling the recovery community in the Twin Cities is very vibrant. And we've had some piece in that. And we have other locations. We have our youth site for young adults and young people in Plymouth, Minnesota. We have a site in Chaska. We have a site in Maple Grove. We have our Center City site. And we'll have more sites in the Midwest as we continue to grow, because people are in crisis right now. And we're just trying as fast as possible to upscale our capacity to help. A lot has happened, but I'm actually hopeful that after the pandemic, people will become more empathic and understanding of some of the struggles that people with addiction and mental health issues have.
I appreciate that. And for those of you, since you're listening, you can't see, like I get to see Dr. Lee, he's got a very joyful, clearly he's a smiling, happy, engaged, optimistic person. It shows all over his face. And so I get to watch you as we're talking. I want to ask you about hope. We started our conversation with hope. I'd like to end it as the idea of hope as well. You're in an industry that can be burdensome. It can weigh you down spiritually, and you know, and yet you have this beautifully joyful face. Tell me about what keeps you hopeful, you know, professionally or personally, as you look forward.
You know, what keeps me hopeful is a grounded and humble optimism that we can do better. And you get rewarded along the way. A lot of people have thanked me in my career journey, like they're thanks Dr. Lee for this and that, but actually I'm the one that's grateful to have been a part of their lives. You know, I'm the one that's been blessed. And so when you get to, even though there's tragedy along the way, when you see so many success stories and even people who have suffered loss, you see their grace and their compassion for trying to help out other people. That community gives you a lot of hope, because when you think about how polarized society is and you think about all the ways that our society needs healing, not just with the pandemic, but just with civil discourse and everything, the recovery community that I'm in touch with every day has something to share with the world about humility and empathy and grace. And when I think about those things, it makes me smile and it gives me hope that if this group of people who've been through the gauntlet of suffering through addiction can find that kind of solace, then I think people in society can also find that solace. And that's got to give you hope.
And there's something to be said for coming to the end of yourself and understanding those edges. And then in recovery, there's got to be a certain, as you say, grace and solace and having seen the ends of yourself and not liking what you see. And yet, now that we know that, now we're going to do things differently. We know better, therefore we do better. That is a powerful experience of transformation. And I've seen it as well. So, and I appreciate your time. And, you know, I have one final question for you, which speaks to my work, our work, and how we can be more valuable to you. I like to ask our speakers and my visitors, why is a chamber valuable in the marketplace, given the really important work that you do? What can we do to be more impactful and valuable in this region, would you say?
Oh, I think the chamber can be incredibly a powerful ally. I'll just give you one example. But you think about the pandemic and employee well-being, and the chamber really serving as a bridge for businesses and other organizations being community partners in a true sense of the form. And you start with something as simple as employee wellness. And right now people call it EAP, but it doesn't have a great connotation. And you think about these recovery stories and the humanism in it. And you think about recasting that whole employee wellness experience and really being partners with the community and giving organizations and industries the courage to look at their employee health in a radically different way by convening and bringing people together and sending the right message and giving the tools. So I think the chamber is a really powerful ally in community public health, actually, through its channels and its partnerships.
Hmm. I really appreciate that. Thank you for that. I'm going to be giving some more thought about that and being more intentional about that. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. I want to keep talking with you. But I wanted to thank you again, most sincerely, for visiting. I know you're busy. We appreciate both your time and all that your organization has done and will continue to do for the community.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's been an absolute honor.
Well, thanks all of you for joining us for Bee's Table Talk. Tune in again for more conversations with business leaders in the greater MSP region, hearing from them on how their organizations are growing and investing in the region. Thanks to all, and we will see you in the trenches.